Welcome back. This is Kootenai Co-op Radio 93.5 FM CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicoopradio.com. And if you're down the lake, 96.5 FM Kootenai Lake. This is Fane of the Cosmos. I'm one of your hosts, Dustin Sunflower.
And I'm Reverend DeMuzzi, and we're back with Susan Boyd, and we're going to discuss her book, From Witches to Crack Moms, Women, Drug Law, and Policy. And let's get her on the line, Dusty.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
So Susan, we were just talking about cocaine and its many socio-political aspects. Let's talk about some of its pharmacological aspects. Now, your book talks quite a bit, it gets into the use of euphoric substances by pregnant women.
Mm-hmm.
Is there evidence that cocaine is harmful for pregnant women?
There's not what you might call specific evidence that it's harmful. I think it's interesting to note that when we talk about cocaine, it has a similar impact on pregnancies as tobacco does. But we don't really hear anyone talking about tobacco babies. And I'll try to make this a little more explicit. Even last year, about 27 leading medical doctors and scientists in the U.S. wrote a letter to the media there asking them to stop perpetuating myths about crack babies and meth babies, and especially the derogatory term crack baby, which relates to babies who have been exposed to maternal cocaine use. And they told them to stop using that term because it stigmatizes the infants, and there's absolutely no scientific validity to the term. And they also said that through almost 20 years of research, none of those scientists or physicians and researchers have been able to recognize a condition or a syndrome or a disorder that could be termed crack baby.
So the children were normal? Like, there's nothing they could see in the children that would say, this is a crack baby?
No, there isn't. But what there is that we can see, and I think this is important, is that for poor women who are pregnant, they have poorer maternal outcomes than women who are not. And what we see with children that have been exposed to maternal drug use, occasionally what we see is higher rates of low birth weight, sudden infant death syndrome, prenatal death, and preterm deliveries. But they're what we call nonspecific, because we see that same high rate in poor women and women who smoke cigarettes. So you can't separate and say, oh, this is due to cocaine, you know, or maternal exposure to cocaine. Mostly you can say is that we see this outcome for women who are poor, for some women who use cocaine who are poor, for women who smoke cigarettes and are poor. You know, so it's not a specific effect. And that's very different if you think about children who may be exposed to narcotics. There's one specific effect, and it's not all children, but some children may experience withdrawal symptoms because they've been exposed to heroin or methadone or codeine, you know, all the narcotics. But not every child does, but you could say withdrawal is specific to the drug. But there isn't something specifically related to cocaine, though we do see these, you know, for poor women anyway, these higher rates of low birth weight, preterm deliveries, perinatal death. And some of the research suggests that there's what they call vasoconstriction, and that can lead to sort of miscarriage and early, you know, preterm babies as well. But we see that with tobacco too. So you see, it's not so clear-cut what the effect of a drug can be. It's not, you know, similarly, if we have a drug like thalidomide, which caused terrible abnormalities in children, we could say that was specific to that drug. Well, you can't do that with cocaine.
So before we get into more of the issues and stuff surrounding pregnant women and drug use, your book briefly addresses witches as well. And even before I talk about that, I wanted to say, now you're a professor at the University of Victoria, right?
Yes.
And a lot of the I guess the positioning in this book, the sentiment in this book strikes me, and just from what I've talked to you about too, I know that you've done some amazing things for people, and that you align yourself strongly with sort of a feminist politics, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
Is it? Have you found that other people who align themselves in that way, that they may criticize you for your position on pregnant women and drug use?
I think early on that was the case. We could say that in the 1970s, 1980s, because most of the sort of heavy-handedness around women and drugs really took off in the mid-1980s, though there was lots going on beforehand, but it wasn't as public, in the media and in movies, sort of in the public imagination the way it is today. But when I first started writing about this, feminists and other critical writers did, they did criticize me. And I think they hadn't really investigated that the whole maternal drug issue could be a construction in itself. And basically we talk about, well, women need treatment, that we need to do these things for women, but didn't really investigate the term needle-nadle abstinence syndrome or fetal alcohol syndrome, all of those constructs, to see what they were really about. And so my work was one of the first to sort of explore that in a larger way, and to really, what I wished to do was to bring attention to what was happening to those infants, but also to what was going on with the mothers, because of my work here in Vancouver and seeing firsthand when I was working as an outreach worker, moms having their children taken away from them, apprehended and put into the hospital and treated for neonatal abstinence syndrome, and most of those children were permanently apprehended. So I wanted to bring that, what I thought was a terrible practice to the public. But I guess I could say that there has been a lot of change, and now there's a number of feminist activists who look at maternal drug use in the same way as I do. Lynn Paltrow in New York, who's the head of the National Advocates for Pregnant Women. She's just a champion for women who have been charged with maternal drug use and criminalized in the United States due to their activities during pregnancy.
Wow. No.
So your work covers, I'd like the listeners to understand that your work covers a broad issue that this comes under, and that is the use of these kinds of terms as crack babies and women who don't take care of their children, and this has kind of a more the continuation of the patriarchal dominance of mm-hmm. women and the patriarchal to bring women down and to make them the focus of we don't do these things with fathers. And that, if you could just comment on that, you can.
One of the things I started, the first book I wrote, it was called Mothers and Illicit Drugs, Transcending the Myths. And part of that was I wanted to, make public what was going on with women, how they're regulated through the medical profession, through criminal justice and through social services, and how that regulation overlaps and even competes with itself. And so it really places women in a very vulnerable position. And that regulation is quite different than it is in relation to men. I'm not saying that men aren't arrested for drug charges. They are, and they are regulated in drug treatment in prisons. But with women, a lot of the focus goes around whether or not they're good mothers, whether they're fit mothers. There's a lot of focus around the regulation of their sexuality, whether they're abiding by their proper gender roles, being the good girl, the good daughter, and then on to good mother. And so I saw that there were these specific differences, especially around apprehension, because most children that are apprehended from poor families, and most of those families are single-parent mothers. So I wanted to look at those gender differences. But in my second book, From Witches to Crack Moms, my question was, I think it was more historical in the sense that I wanted to trace back how women were regulated and when did that start and when were the first drug scares that marginalized women in a specific way.
Uh-huh.
And so I just started to go back in history and went as far as the witch hunts, because that was the first sort of drug scare that I could find in sort of a Western context anyway, where women's independence, their sexuality, reproduction, the herbs that they took, the medicines that they used became suspect. And women were, you know, we know now, you know, persecuted and
demonized.
Evicted and demonized. And, you know, a lot of those women were sort of the political dissenters, the midwives, the healers of their communities. And it's interesting, the witch hunts. I mean, men were also persecuted during that time as well, but about 80% of the people who were convicted and then executed were women.
Yeah.
And so if we look back, too, at The Witch's Hammer, which was a book that two Dominican monks wrote in the 1400s, it specifically talks about the witches, and it completely sexualizes witches and the fear that they had about women's power and their use of herbs. And they were really quite upset that any type of healing could happen during pregnancy or birth, too, that, you know, women should suffer during birth, and that anyone that helped them in any way, you know, would be seen as a witch.
Well, I think they were even excommunicated, weren't they, temporarily for a certain amount of time after giving birth?
Oh, I don't know about that, but that's interesting. I wouldn't doubt it from, you know, reading The Witch's Hammer and other historical work around that era.
And I think that's why the, you know, it was considered so dirty that, you know, that the church doctors couldn't involve themselves in this work. So that's why the midwives had to step in. There was nobody else to do this work, and they had to come in and do this for the women.
Yeah. That's right. And we have to think about it, too, that the medical profession, it's a fairly new profession. And, you know, they've been around for centuries, but they weren't available to most people. I mean, women in rural areas and poor women, they didn't have, you know, access to doctors the way that we do today. And we can see that with the witch hunts, there was this marginalization of women in the healing practices, as well as a, you know, a criminalization of the types of herbs and medicines that they used. And slowly the medical profession, you know, gained prominence. I mean, we look today, we have alternative medicines, but they're still marginalized to a large extent. You know, even the midwifery movement in Canada, I mean, it's, midwifery is legal,
but it's highly regulated.
Yes, it's highly regulated, and most births are still in the hospital with a doctor. Not that you can't have your child in the hospital with a midwife, you know, that where they practice as well.
Yeah.
But it's just to say that they've still remained marginalized in relation to women's reproduction and healing.
You know what really blew my mind is that these, you know, a lot of the substances that these midwives were using in the medieval ages and were persecuted for, like cannabis, which was used for stalled labors, you know, and it, as you say in your book, again, cannabis also, there's no evidence whatsoever to show that this causes any problems with pregnancies or with children afterwards. But, you know, another thing that you really touched on in your book, which is, what are these substances, what have they been replaced with? And they've been replaced with pharmaceutical drugs. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I will, because even I'm pretty amazed. That was one area I hadn't explored as much in my earlier work, and I started to look at it more closely because, well, starting back with the witches, I saw that some of the drugs that they had used to help women through their pregnancies and at their birth were similar drugs that we now use, you know, though synthetic drugs. But I started to take a look at the drugs that we use and to see that really this line between illegal drugs and legal drugs is illusionary. I mean, many of the drugs that we criminalize have the same pharmacological properties as the drugs that we take legally. But I started to look at the pharmaceutical industry and sort of when did it emerge. And now today, you know, and the pharmaceutical industry worldwide has, you know, spent about $13 billion advertising their products. And but it really didn't take off until about the 1950s, and it, that era we call sort of the sort of a revolution in the psychedelic or the pharmaceutical industry. And when we look back, we see that in 1965, there was only about 300 prescribed drugs on the market, where in 2002, we had 9,500 prescription drugs on the market. So you can see that our drug taking has just changed tremendously. And part of this has to do with the creation of synthetic drugs. Instead of using natural drugs, we've moved to creating new compounds and synthetic drugs. And one of the reasons that this has happened is that it's not so easy to patent a natural drug. And you can constantly come up with new compounds that can be patented. And for the pharmaceutical industry, those patents last for, 10 years to 25 years. And you can't sell, other companies can't sell that drug at the same time that you are, as long as you have a patent on it. So it's quite interesting that this has been occurring. And I guess you could say that shift occurred in the mid-1800s, but we really didn't see the shift until the 1950s, when we had the discovery of, different drugs like Librium and Valium and the antidepressants, and that just brought in a whole new era of drug use to North Americans.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. One of the drugs that you mentioned here is thalidomide, which was used for stalled labors as well, and the side effects of that were, infamously awful.
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, women were prescribed that in Canada and Europe, for pregnant women to help them with nausea. And we know that those children were born without...
What, brother? No.
Sorry, I think that... did you hear that on air there?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some talking in the background?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think the kill switch is working.
That means?
Sorry, it just means that on this end, that when we actually try to turn down the volume in the studio, that people are still hearing what we're saying.
Oh, okay.
So that's good just to keep in mind. Bush, and so the last thing before the break, and then we're going to come back and talk to you some more, is I wanted to talk to you about Bush and his relationship to the pharmaceutical companies that provide these things.
Okay.
So we're going to go to a song?
Well, just a sec.
Okay.
Right now, and in your book, you say, you mention here that President Bush Sr. was on the board of Eli Lilly before
That's right. He was on the board, and he gave that position up when he became president. But also, Dan Quayle was on the board, I think, of Eli Lilly, too. And I think what's important is to think about the president and a lot of our politicians, their connections to sort of, corporate America, and whose interests are they serving? Are they serving, the interests of people, everyday people, or are they serving the interests of corporations such as the pharmaceutical industry? And I think that we can see that they probably are. I mean, even with the war in Iraq, it seems pretty obvious that President Bush Jr., is serving the interests of the oil industry, in his own interest, too. And we have the same thing with the pharmaceutical industry. They're very powerful. I mean, they're powerful in the sense that they're very profitable. I mean, we're drug takers, Canadians and Americans and Europeans. I think we can see that very clearly when we think about Africa. The drug market, they make up about 1% of the drug market, even though they have tremendous health problems like malaria, things that, AIDS. But the money is in North America and Europe and Japan for the drug industry.
Well, okay, so we're going to go to a song now. Thanks for giving us this first part of the interview. The next part of the interview, we're going to get into the really juicy stuff. We want to talk about the court cases, the women who have actually been oppressed by this war on drugs, and your book covers it in great detail. So that'll be in the second half of this interview.
Okay. So just
hold on the line there for us, Susan.
Yeah, let's try and cover as many of the things that the patriarchy uses, all the different elements to this,
the legal mechanisms.
Yeah, the mechanisms of this.
Okay.
Like, okay, we'll be right back.
Okay.
Choo, choo, choo.
Back, you're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio 93.5 FM CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson, British Columbia, and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicoopradio.com. If you're at the north end of the lake, this is 96.5 FM Kootenai Lake.
And our featured speaker tonight is Susan Boyd. She's a professor at the University of Victoria, and we're talking to her about her book, Witches to Crack Moms. And Susan, your book, to me, it feels like a statement about how the war on drugs is used as a tool of the patriarchy to oppress women. And I want to start getting into some of the deeper aspects of that, the legal cases. Some of the things that happened are just shocking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
could you tell us about, you know, how did the legal aspect get started? Like, who was the first one to try and get at women, pregnant women, female drug users? What was the first thing that happened?
Well, I think we started to see in the 1950s and 1960s, sort of with the sort of counterculture movement, but also there was a lot more heroin use going on in the middle classes that was related a little bit to the Vietnam vets coming home. There's quite a few books that talk about that sort of increase in heroin, other drugs in the sort of inner cities and other places in the United States and other Western nations. Anyway, at that time there was some concern by physicians about women coming in who were addicted to heroin, and that was mostly the concern at that time. But what we saw in the 70s was I guess you could call it a more liberal views about drug use. So many middle-class youth and, you know, other people were using drugs that there started to be some shifts that were going on in the late 60s and 70s about drugs and altered states of consciousness. By the 80s, though, and maybe you could see it as a backlash to that more liberal time, we saw the emergence of the what you might call the crack scare in the United States in the mid-80s, and they created a bunch of laws that were really draconian around crack use instead of cocaine. And there seemed to be this just amazing movement once again, sort of a new drug scare, and the war on drugs really took off at that time. And it was very much centered around women as well. But I guess I would say that I do see the drug law as seeing women, you know, especially pregnant women, as being the newest terrain for the war on drugs. But I also want to be careful to say that I think that the drug war is also, you know, it's a racialized policy. It's also class-based, mm-hmm. because especially in the United States, we see that it's people of color who most often feel the impact of the drug war. But I'm not trying to suggest that people of other ethnicities don't and races don't, but just to be clear about that. But what started happening with women, we saw the first criminal case in the U.S. Happened in 1977 when this one woman, Margaret Rios, was charged in the state of California with two counts of felony child endangerment. And they said that her twin infants exhibited symptoms of what we call neonatal abstinence syndrome when the children were born. And usually what that referred to at that time was that they experienced some withdrawal symptoms from narcotics. On appeal, this case was dismissed, but we see it as a landmark case in the sense that prosecutors started to think about this, and other people, moral reformers, you know, started to talk about women being unfit, especially women drug users, not being responsible parents. And that went on until the 80s, when the crack scare, along with the media, sort of brought to the public imagination this idea of the crack baby. And we were told at that time that these babies would be an underclass of children, that they would totally stress our public health education, that they're born criminals, that they would be entering the criminal justice system because they had no brains. It was just these terrible descriptions of these crack babies that were totally unsubstantiated. I mean, there was absolutely no scientific evidence to suggest that this was true.
And they were trying to mirror the kind of fetal alcohol syndrome,
yes,
idea.
Completely. But there is no syndrome related to crack or cocaine at all. But a lot of these early claims, you know, politicians heard them, and we know today, you know, the sort of the law and order politician seems to get votes. And prosecutors took this up too, because if you want to get famous and well known, well, why not, you know, charge a woman with, you know, trafficking to the fetus? Your name is going to be in the papers all over the nation.
It's even better than Save Our Children, eh? Save Our Fetus.
Now, did we cover that? Trafficking to the fetus?
Trafficking? No, we haven't. So
that's interesting. That was Jennifer Johnson, right?
Oh, my
that
God.
That was Jennifer Johnson. She had the landmark case, and that was in 1989. She was a young black woman in the States, and she was convicted of trafficking to the fetus. And basically what had happened, the prosecutor in that case argued that Jennifer had delivered cocaine to her newborn after it was born, but through the attached umbilical cord, seconds before it was cut. And so therefore, what they were saying was that the drugs weren't delivered to the fetus because there were these difficulties because you couldn't use the regular drug statutes, the regular drug laws, because they didn't have drug laws at that time to cover trafficking to the fetus. So they had to prove in court that it was trafficking to a live child. So they said that it was delivered through the umbilical cord seconds after the child was born.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was crazy. The children never tested positive for cocaine at birth or any of those things. But regardless of all these facts, the judge sentenced her to a year at a residential drug treatment program and 14 years of probation. And she had all of these criteria. She wasn't successful at treatment or didn't comply with her probation or order. And then she would go to prison.
She had to undergo,
you know, random drug testing, and they tried to regulate her future pregnancies as well. And the thing that I think we forget is that, I mean, Jennifer ended up not going, you know, she ended up being in prison for, you know, a short period of time, but she was also, you know, separated from her children because of that earlier court decision. And this is what's happened. There's been over 300 women in the United States have been charged under statutes that we have for, you know, well, under looking at maternal drug use, so trafficking to the fetus, manslaughter, endangerment to the fetus, those types of charges that were never originally, we never thought that they would be used in relation to pregnancy and drugs. And so trying to stretch the meaning of those laws.
Yeah.
But what's also happened as well is that in the United States, there's new civil welfare laws that have been created in about 18 states that see maternal drug use as being child abuse. So all these new laws and statutes have been created to regulate any woman who's suspected of doing harm to the fetus or to their born children. But most of that centers around maternal drug use.
There's some real horror stories here, too. I mean, the story of Julia Starks.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, Julia Stark, that was a very sad. I mean, they're all sad cases, but Julia's case was quite interesting in the sense that she was arrested in 1999, and her case stands out in the sense that she was 7 months pregnant, and she was arrested while she was on site of what was considered to be a methamphetamine lab. And she was arrested with the father of her unborn child. And initially, they were charged with manufacturing and possession of methamphetamine. But at that time, the trial court, they took temporary emergency custody of Julie, of the viable fetus. So, again, they were trying to apprehend the fetus. And this has gone on in Canada and the United States, this idea of apprehending the fetus. Normally, under our statutes, in protection of children, you can only apprehend the live child. But what's been going on in order to protect the fetus from the mother, because she's seen as a threat to the developing fetus, welfare agencies have tried to come in and apprehend the fetus. So this happened to her, and she was ordered into foster care until her child was born. And she had to complete an alcohol and drug assessment. She was put in prison for, I think it was about 36 days that she was in prison. And at that time, she was fed a really inadequate diet, and she developed an infection, and she lost quite a bit of weight and became dehydrated. And you could possibly argue that that was more of a risk, her time in prison, than her being on the site of an alleged methamphetamine lab.
To the child.
Yes.
Yeah.
And anyway, she did. She gave, you know, birth to her child, but at that time, the child decided that they would apprehend her, you know, child right after it was born. They took emergency custody of her because they saw it as a deprived child due to her arrest. It was just a crazy case, but she ended up, you know, not only having that time in prison, but her child was separated from her for quite a long time, and, you know, through the efforts of her lawyer and herself, she's together now with her child, but they paid a huge price. And this is what's going on in the United States. I mean, many women have been charged with you know, manslaughter, trafficking to the fetus or endangering the fetus, maternal drug use, child abuse because of maternal drug use, you know, even with just one positive urine at the time of birth. And that's what was going on. There was a case, the cases in South Carolina that I wrote about. In South Carolina, they had a program that was set up by the local police, a prosecutor, and the medical staff in Charleston, in South Carolina. They started this program in 1989, and the medical staff worked with the police for over 5 years, and what would happen when women came in to deliver, they were searched. And if there was any evidence that there was drug use, they would then test those women without their consent as well.
Wait a sec, did they...
warrants.
Sorry to interrupt you, Susan. Did they search all the women, or how did they decide who to search?
Just the black women.
Yeah, it was mostly... It was all poor women, but it was mostly black women that they searched. And so that's where we can see the, you know, the war on drugs is definitely... It's class-based, it's racialized, and there is this gendered, you know, drug policy that focuses on women around reproduction and constantly assessing whether or not they're good or bad mothers. But that was the case in Charleston in this program, that it was all poor women. But interesting enough with this is that if the women did test positive at that time, some of these women, they shackled them immediately after birth and
shackled
them.
Say that again.
Yes.
They shackled the pregnant women.
Yeah, and just after they had their child, and then they escorted them to prison in their hospital gowns, you know, while they were still bleeding in pain and recovering from childbirth. It was just an amazing
Like going through the childbirthing experience, having your child ripped away with blood still running down your thighs, put into shackles, and led off to your prison cell or to your hospital room.
Yeah, and the hospital staff, they just argued that given the danger to the developing fetus, you know, from maternal cocaine, that their policy was justified. So 10 women actually challenged that policy, and they sued the state for violating their civil rights. It was
quite
an interesting case, and it went right to the Supreme Court, and they actually won their case.
Good,
yeah.
Which is one of the better stories of what's going on in the United States.
But just because recently in the States, we're actually sworn never to talk about abortion rights and stuff on the radio, so I'm not going to talk much about that. But the idea that laws that are extremist like this are playing to that kind of fundamentalist conservative right in trying to establish that the fetus is a person that, you know.
I think that's the next thing too that we're sort of getting to, is that that was the workaround for the laws. You know, they were trying to get at the fetus, but they couldn't, so they made it. And that was just recently, and that was under Bush too, wasn't it, Susan?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting since Bush has come, you know, since he pretty well stole the election and then was elected the next time. He's really done an amazing reversal on women's reproductive rights. One of the first things that he did in 2002 is that he extended health care to the developing fetus, but he didn't extend it to poor women or pregnant women. It's just to the developing fetus. And people criticize that because what they're saying is that these new acts, it defines the fetus as a person. You know, it's this slowly eroding, or it's slowly moving towards this idea that the fetus is a person that has rights, legal rights, like a live child or an adult does. The other thing that Bush did in 2003 was that, I know we're not allowed to talk about abortion, but or talk about it much, but I'll just say that he also criminalized late-term abortions. The other thing that he did in 2004 was that he created he signed into law the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. And what this does is it creates a separate federal offense for any individual who, during another crime, causes harm or bodily harm to the child in utero, so to the fetus. So if I go and, you know, rob somebody and I push them and they fall, I can be, you know, I could be charged with this Unborn Victims of Violence Act.
Or if they're like, does it, like if the woman miscarried, then
no,
you would be murdered?
No, she doesn't have to miscarry anything. They can be charged with
violence against
violence.
The person inside.
Yeah, it's just a Victims of Violence Act. So there doesn't have to be a miscarry, or the fetus doesn't have to be
But more to the point, though, this whole law has developed into a situation where, and I know that in at least one state, I think it's California, that there's now there's a prosecutor who is prosecuting women, or has at least prosecuted one woman, a test case, for drug use. Are you familiar with this case?
I'm not sure. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, apparently her idea is that if you basically, because now the fetus is considered a person, and Bush apparently signed this act into law under the, basically claiming that it was so that he could get Medicaid to, you know, these, to women who, you know, basically prenatal care to women on
right.
Medicaid,
it's
right?
Health care. Yeah.
Because now the unborn child is considered a human being or a full, mm-hmm. for full person status.
Right.
But what actually ended up happening was they used that and they said, well, okay, well, if that's a person, now we can use the drug laws, and it doesn't matter if the fetus is still in the woman's stomach, we can say that she was trafficking to that fetus. And so there were now some prosecutions based on that.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, there were women being prosecuted beforehand, but this would actually make it, you know, this is the argument that it would make it much easier to prosecute women for, you know, causing harm to the fetus, whether it be trafficking or manslaughter, any of those things. Because basically, it's extending legal rights to the fetus. And when that happens, what we see is that it further erodes women's reproductive rights.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been, you know, I guess you could say the horrible scenario that's been being played out is that by granting rights to the fetus, we take away rights from women and their, you know, their autonomy around their body.
Mm-hmm.
And we say that, okay, you know, when you're pregnant, you no longer have any rights. You know, you're not allowed to participate in certain activities. If you decide that you don't want to take your doctor's advice, you know, we can see that as a danger to the fetus. You know, any drugs that you take, any activities that you do could be, you know, lead to you having your child apprehended or you being, you know, charged with a criminal offense because of that behavior. You know, it's quite problematic, this whole issue. And a lot of people are saying that what President Bush is doing, you know, at this time and has been since he's come into office, is that he's pretty well giving a message to, you know, this sort of anti-abortion movement or, you know, right-to-life movement to say, well, I can't turn back yet. Roe versus Wade, you know, that gave rights to women to have abortions, but I can do these things. And we'll slowly just whittle away their rights by coming at it from the back door almost.
Well, I found it here. It was Alma Baker, and she was using cannabis to treat nausea and increase her appetite. And it was in Texas, not California. But her twin babies were drug tested right after birth, and they found positive for cannabis. And she was interrogated and then admitted to having a couple tokes in her backyard and was eventually, I think, plea bargained. And but I'm sorry, Dustin, what were you going to say?
No, that is mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
Women who are listening right now, imagine having nausea when you have morning sickness, having a little puff of cannabis to ease that nausea, and then being hauled off because your fetus might have benefited from the medicinal aspects. But what I'm thinking is, when a woman gives birth, at birth, there's a large flush of dimethyltryptamine from the brain as the baby is born that goes through the umbilicus, that it's in the child. Well, if they tested the child for dimethyltryptamine, you know what I mean? Like, where do you draw the line between natural drugs that are released during pregnancy and ones that are controlled substances? You know, like...
Well, this is a good question, but we could also ask a question. I mean, one of the reasons that I was interested in this subject was not only my work downtown, but when I was pregnant with my last child, I was at Women's Hospital for weeks because I was threatening to go into early labor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just amazed because I had had my first child at home with a midwife. And, you know, I knew that pregnancy and reproduction was medicalized, you know, and that women still took drugs and during their pregnancy and at labor. But I couldn't believe the array of drugs that were offered to me when I was there. And, you know, some of them I would have been happy to take anything to, you know, what I felt was to save my pregnancy, you know, so I didn't lose the pregnancy. But what I kept seeing over and over again was that women were offered legal drugs in the hospital to manage their pregnancies, and they were seen as good mothers, you know, and behaving in ways that were, that we would say were beneficial to the pregnancy.
She was looking after the child by taking the pills.
That's
she was
right.
doing the responsible thing.
That's right.
She was taking care of her child.
And during her labor, if she's offered drugs, she's considered to be doing the responsible thing once again. And I don't want to judge whether, you know, what drugs women take during their pregnancy, but I just think it's hypocritical that we would marginalize and criminalize the behaviors of some women, you know, who are taking illegal drugs like cannabis during their pregnancy or labor. But we don't say anything about this medicalization of reproduction that goes on that's legal.
Morphine,
and how birth
morphine.
Has been, you know, really taken from women.
Well, I heard it was common practice, and I also heard from a female friend of mine who had something similar happen to her, that they would, you know, if you had a labor that they wanted it to last a little bit longer, they thought it was too quick, they would inject you with morphine. And this was apparently was common practice.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't doubt stories like that. I mean, there's quite a number of, you know, terrible horror stories. And that's one of the reasons that the midwifery movement, you know, emerged in North America, was to challenge this sort of medicalization of birth and to try to normalize birth for women again and to look into natural births and, you know, try to wrest it away from the medical profession. So it just, for me, it's just so hypocritical that we would turn around and, with the compliance of the medical profession often, and criminalize these women, or, you know, in Canada it's been more apprehending their children and separating from their children than criminalizing, because we haven't gone that far here. But I do want to bring your attention, because, you know, I often use the United States as my examples because it's so blatant there, and it's such a terrible situation for women in relation to their reproductive rights and the war on drugs. But I do want to say that in 2002, the Canadian Alliance MP, Keith Martin, he's currently a Liberal MP now, he's from Esquimalt, he introduced a private members bill. It was Bill C-233, and it was an act to amend our criminal code, and it was to grant protection to a child before birth. So it was, the bill was to amend the criminal code to extend legal personhood to the fetus and to make an offense for any woman who's pregnant and who is going to carry that pregnancy to term. It would be an offense if she consumed any substance that was harmful to the fetus.
Except for pharmaceutical drugs.
You know, it was just an amazing...
Or morphine if a doctor gives it to you.
Or alcohol.
Well, the interesting thing was that it said alcohol or any substance harmful to the fetus, and it didn't really spell out which ones they were, but, you know, you could imagine what they might be. But it also... authorized that the courts could confine women in treatment facilities during their pregnancy and to make them report to a physician on a weekly basis in order to continue to protect the fetus. So this, you know, the bill wasn't ratified, thank goodness. You know, thank goodness for women in Canada. But it's just to say that this sort of ideology about regulating women, you know, is alive and well in Canada. And we've done pretty well up here to subvert that, and we had a major Supreme Court case in 1977 that was around pregnancy and solvent use, and at that time the Supreme Court of Canada ruled very strongly that you can't detain women in drug treatment, you know, to protect the fetus, and that you can't apprehend a fetus, that only live children can be apprehended by the state. And that's very different than what's going on in the United States. We also have a new program up at Women's Hospital called First Square, and it started last year, and it's focused around harm reduction and It's a place where women who are using substances can go and they can detox if they want to or stabilize, and there's not an automatic sort of apprehension of the children. You know, they're what they're trying to do is to create a space for women who are visible drug users, you know, for drugs like cocaine or heroin or methadone or whatever it might be, legal drugs as well, but that they have a place where they can be offered good medical services and be in contact with welfare without fear of apprehension. You know, and they help people if they're homeless, you know, to find, to connect them with agencies that will help them with housing.
Yeah. Hey, Susan, I want to ask, you know, we did talk about the studies that revolve around crack, cocaine, and pregnancy,
yeah.
But we haven't really talked too much about the studies that revolve around marijuana and pregnancy. And we're running close on our hour, so I want to ask you, could you just outline that a bit more?
Yeah. I think it's so interesting, the studies around marijuana, and I think that's probably a place that we should talk about, because most people who use drugs are using marijuana. I mean, they're not using the other drugs. It's very rare that people are using heroin or cocaine during their pregnancies. But women tend to use marijuana, and part of that reason is that women have found some relief in using marijuana in relation to nausea or helping them sleep, those kind of things. But in relation to pregnancy, there was a great study that was done in Jamaica, and I think you're familiar with that study yourself, but in that study they followed women during their pregnancies and after birth, and they did assessments of the children, and what they found was difficult was to try to find a group of women who were pregnant and then gave birth that were only using marijuana, because most of the studies have been done in the United States or in Canada, and so they're using marijuana, but they may be tobacco smokers or they drink alcohol too, so you couldn't really separate what was the effect of the marijuana on the pregnancy. But what they found in the study was that the Jamaican women who used marijuana heavily during their pregnancy actually had healthier babies than the women who were lighter users or non-users of marijuana. And this completely, you know, challenged all of the literature that was coming out of the United States that was saying that marijuana caused withdrawn babies and tremors and other things. You know, they associated with those kind of symptoms. But what's interesting about their study, I think, was that when they talked about the women who were heavy users of marijuana, they also mentioned that they were better educated. They were more financially independent than the other women. They had fewer children, and they had less childcare responsibilities and more people in the home to help them. And I thought that was so interesting. But they also said that the women who used marijuana heavily, that they didn't see marijuana the way our sort of, you know, war on drug pundits see it. They saw it as having healing properties, and they felt that it really increased their appetite, helped them with, you know, helped relieve fatigue, and provided some rest during their pregnancy, and of course, the relieving of nausea. So it was a lot of the women were Rastafarians. The other thing they noted was that, of course, they saw marijuana as a sacred herb. And so for them, they were doing something that was positive for their pregnancy, and they saw it as maintaining their overall health, and that would include pregnancy and birth. So that research, I think, is quite interesting. But what it really says, too, is that it's not just the drug. You know, you can't look at pregnancy and drugs and say, oh, the drugs did that. Because that really isn't true. You have to look at the social and the cultural and the economic characteristics of the mother, because they can override many drug effects. You know, not a drug like thalidomide, you know, because we know that's quite toxic and harmful. But that you can't say ever that it's just the drug. And I think the Jamaican study really speaks well to why women would use marijuana, you know, especially, you know, I guess my only thing about marijuana that I would say is, you know, you want to use marijuana that's organic and hasn't been sprayed, because then we do have problems. And I don't know what they are specifically, but I think it's best, you know, if women were going to use that, a good harm reduction philosophy would be to try to find out, you know, was the marijuana sprayed in any way? I mean, were there any chemicals used on the marijuana?
Right on.
Go ahead.
I was going to thank you for being on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add, or?
No, I guess what I maybe in closing is just to say that I think it's important for all women and men to look at this issue, because there's always that sense, oh, it's those women, you know, I don't have to be concerned because, you know, no one's going to scrutinize my pregnancy. And for every pregnant woman, there's a father somewhere. And I think this really is a large issue, and it's one that it can so easily sort of capture people's imagination, because I think, oh, that poor child, that fetus, you know, how could you harm that child? But I think we have to turn it around and ask ourselves, how could we support women and men to have healthier, you know, pregnancies and maternal outcomes? And the one thing that we do know that causes the most harm in pregnancy, the one social factor, is poverty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we don't have a war on poverty right now. You know, we're not interested in alleviating poverty, racism, sexism, you know, in a big way. And so I think we need to turn it around and say, let's alleviate poverty. That's the best way that we could help women and men. That's the best way that we could have good maternal outcomes. If we really did care about that issue, criminalizing women and stigmatizing them, apprehending their children, all that's going to do is marginalize and hurt a lot of people. You know,
yeah.
So I think we need to just get rid of all that sort of punishment and discipline and you know, look towards more peaceful solutions.
Yeah, instead of a war on the fall guy of drugs, let's have a war on poverty, or even better yet, let's have a peace on poverty.
Yeah,
and just get
peace
rid
on
of it.
Poverty. I
yeah.
think that would be a great thing.
Totally.
Thanks for being on the show, Susan. Your book just, it was so amazing, the facts in there. Some of them just peeled my brain open.
Dan won't lend me his. I need to ask you to send me one.
Okay.
I'll send you a money order or something, but he won't let me read it because it's so good.
Okay.
And I need a copy. And
I'm I'll like, send one up for sure.
It's, yeah, your work. Thank you so much. Like,
well, thanks for having
crucial,
me on the show.
It's crucial to expose these mechanisms because it doesn't do good for anybody.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't. And if you're ever out this way,
come on up.
Place to stay. You've got,
yeah.
Yeah, we will take care of you.
Well,
and if you have kids, too.
Yeah,
and,
I do.
Okay, perfect. We got lakes, we got mountains. So.
No, I know it's beautiful up there. I go up there quite a bit, actually.
Okay, good. We'll stop in and we'll have tea or something.
That'd be great.
Cool.
Look forward to it.
Yeah.
Okay, happy full moon coming up.
Yeah.
Blessings, Susan. Professor Boyd, thank you for being on the show.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Okay.
Good night.
Night.
Bye. Man, oh man,
wasn't that great?
Rama Ding Dong, like, she blew my Nubian. Like, I just can't believe this. We gotta get her on the show again.
Yeah, she was really good. And, you know, it's interesting that this stuff, you know, what she's really unveiling, another thing besides the, you know, the patriarchal aspects of the war on drugs, she's unveiling the fact that the war on drugs is really, like I said before, is like a fall guy for the war on, for poverty, for all of the things that are caused by poverty. Well, we can just blame that on drugs when it's not really drugs at all. It's the poverty that's causing that.
Yes.
And it's interesting that, you know, that then with that in mind, and she mentions this in her book on page 116, that the that, you know, that there's a eugenics program attached to this whole thing. There's this program called CRAC, which, you know, says basically their motto is why ruin your drug habit with a pregnancy? And they offer women $200 US to come in and be sterilized. And this, again, it's like, okay, well, we'll take the poor people, we'll blame their problems on drugs, and then we'll sterilize them.
That's so screwed.
It's just a way of, it's basically, it's a, you know, it's a class and race war. It's a class and race. It's a genocide.
Oh my
Once
God.
Again, it's and this is at the very dark, you know, the deep dark heart of this whole thing. So kudos to Susan Boyd again. She was our feature interviewee for the night, and she's a University of Victoria professor.
And when we get back, we've got some startling news.